Good morning, everybody. My name is Dan Spencer, and this is the second talk this week on one of the countries in Central America. Yesterday, we looked at El Salvador, the war in El Salvador, its roots, and why it continues. The title of today's talk is The War in Nicaragua, Its Roots, and Why It Continues. And I'm going to try and organize it much the same way that we did yesterday, to give some historical background, to look at the roots of the crisis, and then look at some of the major role players within the crisis so we can understand some of the dynamics taking place there today. And then finally, to look at some reasons why I believe the war continues to go in Nicaragua. For those of you who came in, I work at the Center for Global Service and Education at Augsburg College in Minneapolis. And a lot of my work involves organizing and conducting study delegations to Central America. So I travel to the region about every 2 or 3 months with study delegations and have lived there off and on since for the last 8 years. Start way back a little bit in Nicaragua, Nicaragua history. One thing to understand, and it's important to understand from the Nicaraguan perspective, try and understand through their eyes in order to understand what is happening there. And Nicaragua is the country in Latin America that has been most invaded by the United States. It's been occupied militarily more than 6 times and a number of other military incursions against Nicaragua. And this has been going on since the mid-1800s. That's just important to understand for them to see what their perspective is on their neighbor to the north. Nicaragua follows much of the history that's common to Central America, and some of the dynamics we talked about in El Salvador are common here as well, with the whole emphasis on trying to develop an export economy during the 1800s, particularly one that would center around coffee. But one of the key events took place in 1855. The Central American nations got their independence in 1821, in that period there, but there was a period of several years of civil war as competing factions tried to gain control. And the two major groups were the liberals and the conservatives. The conservatives being much more traditionally aligned with the large landowners, with the Catholic Church, and the conservatives also then in this century begin to side with Great Britain. Well, let me back up just a minute and just show you again where we are on the map. I sketched out some maps here of Central America. Nicaragua is the largest of the Central American republics. It's about the size of Iowa or Wisconsin for Midwesterners, and population of about 3 million people. Just as in comparison, Nicaragua is 5 times as large as El Salvador, but has roughly half the population of El Salvador. So very different dynamics going on within the country. Here is a map of Nicaragua itself, sort of shaped as a large triangle, bordered on by the Caribbean on the east, the Pacific Ocean on the west, Honduras to the north, Costa Rica to the south. And in the 1800s, Great Britain colonized the eastern part of Nicaragua, and Spain had originally colonized the Pacific region, which then was independent. It wasn't until the late 1890s that Great Britain gave up the eastern part of Nicaragua and it became one sovereign nation. But going back to this kind of power struggle between the liberals and the conservatives align themselves with Great Britain, the liberals align themselves with the United States, the two major foreign influences in Central America during this time, and there was a lot of infighting. One of the things that happened in 1855 was a man named William Walker from the United States got together a group of mercenary soldiers and worked together with the liberals to overthrow the conservative government there, the liberals hoping they would come into power. Instead, William Walker named himself president of Nicaragua, declared English to be the official language, and then ruled Nicaragua for about a year until the country rose up and overthrew him. But this was a key turning point throughout much of Central America. You'll hear a lot of reference to this time when the Walker invasion took place. Just a very ironic footnote to this is the current, there's a new ambassador to Honduras was just named a few weeks ago to head the Contra effort there against Nicaragua, and his name, coincidentally, is William Walker. So brings back memories for the people of Nicaragua. Anyway, after this event, the liberals were pretty much discredited in Nicaragua, and the conservatives ruled for several, 30 or 40 years in there, until a man named Zelaya came into power in the late 1800s. He ruled for about 20 years as a dictator, but one of the things that he did was Nicaragua is a very strategic site in Central America, and for a number of reasons, because of its geography, and it's maybe hard to see, but Nicaragua, the southern part of Nicaragua is very flat and low-lying, and there's a large lake here called Lake Nicaragua that's only about 11 or 12 miles from the Pacific Ocean. This lake is connected to the Caribbean Sea by the San Juan River, which is navigable by boats. And so boats can go all the way from the Caribbean up into the lake to within 11 or 12 miles of the coast here. And this, coincidentally, is how the Vanderbilt family gained their fortune during the gold rush. They control the rights to this passage, and gold miners going to California travel through here. But in the late 1800s, there was a lot of interest among the United States and the different European powers in constructing an interocean canal. And the two primary sites they were looking at were Panama, further south here, and across southern Nicaragua. Well, eventually, we all know they chose Panama as the site, and the United States became involved in that in constructing the canal there. But once they chose Panama as the site, it became very important for the United States not to allow competing sites to develop. And the mistake that Zelaya did was, once the United States started working in Panama, he began to negotiate with some of the European countries to have them build a canal across the southern part of Nicaragua. And so in 1909, the U.S. Marines worked with the conservatives to overthrow the Zelaya government and to put into place a conservative government that would not develop a canal. There was a period of many uprisings for 3 years, from 1909 to 1912, but the threat became so great that finally the U.S. Marines entered Nicaragua and occupied it from 1912 to 1933, with about a six-month break in there in the mid-20s. This is one of the key events for understanding the Nicaraguan mindset, as many people in Nicaragua remember when the Marines occupied their country. And this sets the stage for understanding where the ongoing struggle has taken place there. The conservatives ruled, the Marines put into place the conservatives, their kind of allies there, off and on during this period, and the liberals took up arms against them. There were several generals against them. Two of the generals you'll hear a lot about. One was a man named General Somoza. Another was a man named General Sandino. And they organized their troops to fight against the Marines to try and expel them from Nicaragua. In 1926, the Marines reached an agreement with all of the liberal generals, including Somoza, with the exception of one, a man named Augusto Cesar Sandino. Sandino refused to quit fighting as long as the Marines were in Nicaragua. The other liberals worked out an agreement where they could gain some power. And so now Somoza and Sandino, who had been allies, are now on opposite sides of the fighting there. Sandino organizes the peasants throughout the northern part of Nicaragua to continue fighting against the Marine occupation. And eventually in 1933, with the Roosevelt administration, because of the depression and pressure at home, withdrew the Marines from Nicaragua. What they did, however, was to organize and leave behind a National Guard that would work to control basically the same, or do the same function that the Marines had done, that is to keep the dissent down among the people who were organizing. And they put into place General Somoza, who had been the liberal general. And so in 1934, General Somoza and the National Guard are essentially maintaining order through the countryside. But in 1936, Somoza did a military coup, overthrew the government, the president, and then the Somoza family ruled Nicaragua from 1936 to 1979. So 43 years of uninterrupted rule between the first Somoza and his two sons. This becomes very important because the Somoza dictatorship became increasingly repressive and hated by the people, and the people in Nicaragua know that the roots of the Somoza dictatorship come from this period when the Marines were occupying, and that it was in fact the Marines and the U.S. that organized the National Guard and put Somoza into power. There were a lot of, from the beginning, it was a fairly brutal dictatorship, one quote that FDR was asked one time about Somoza, about if there was concern over the human rights violations going on in Somoza, the Somoza government. And FDR, Roosevelt, was quoted as saying, "Somoza may be an SOB, but he's our SOB." And this was much the attitude the United States has had towards governments in Central America. The concern has been to have governments that are friendly and will look out for U.S. interests. And so it was a very tight alliance between the U.S. administrations during this time and the Somoza government each supporting each other. And Somoza, General Somoza during this time was the most loyal ally in many ways the United States has. And if you look at the voting records starting in the mid-40s in the United Nations, no country in the world voted more closely with the United States than Nicaragua. Somoza simply would ask the U.S. ambassador how he was voting and would vote that way. So a very tight relationship between them. During this period, there was increased, much as we see throughout Central America, increased poverty developing as the Somoza family, since this was a family dictatorship, began to gather the wealth around itself. And so there were different opposition movements that grew up during this time. One that becomes important later took place in 1961, and that was the founding of what was known as the Sandinista National Liberation Front. This was a group of radical students, primarily, that began to look back at the history, and they looked at the history of Sandino and what Sandino's fighting against the U.S. influence in Nicaragua. And they took Sandino's name for themselves. In Spanish, if you are a follower of someone, you take the name of the person and you add "ista," and so Sandino, Sandinista. If we were Reaganites, we'd be Reaganistas. If you're a Carterite, you'd be a Carterista. That simply was where Sandinista comes from, followers of Sandino. This formed in 1961 as an armed opposition movement to the Somoza government. For probably the first 15 years, it remained very, very tiny. Never more than maybe 100, 150 people, usually down to about 10 or 15 or 20. They fought up in the mountains of northern Nicaragua, but essentially were like an annoying fly for the government of the Nicaraguan government. But a couple of things began to happen in the 70s that changed the dynamics. And one of the key events that took place in 1972 was a devastating earthquake that hit the capital city of Managua, which sits on the Pacific side, sort of in the center of the country. Many of you may remember this. It took place in December of 72, killed somewhere between 10 and 15,000 people, left 100,000 people homeless. And there was a tremendous outpouring of international relief and development aid to rebuild Nicaragua following this. If some of you remember the baseball player Roberto Clemente from the Pittsburgh Pirates, he was killed in a plane crash when he was trying to deliver aid to Nicaragua. What happened that was so key for the event of this is that the Somoza family set up a mechanism that all of the international aid had to go through his office personally. And he siphoned off most of it. And so most of it never reached the people. I have friends who were down there working with international efforts trying to do relief at that time, and talked about the difficulty that this food aid would come in, but it would go to the National Guard, and the National Guard would take it out and sell it to people who could afford it. And many, many things happened, but Somoza became very, very wealthy out of this experience, and the vast majority of the people remained very poor. Let me just ask, are there people here who have been to Managua? What was your impression of driving into downtown Managua?
Well, it's desolation. There's nothing. The church is just a shell. The roof is falling in. The walls are still there. And there's whole areas where there are no buildings, there are no people, just the remainders of former buildings.
Managua is probably the weirdest city I've ever been in because it isn't a city anymore. It was never rebuilt, and you go downtown and it looks like the earthquake happened last week. It's just rubble and shells of buildings. But most of the money, there was hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars that came into Nicaragua, was not used for wealth or rebuilding. Was added to the Nicaragua or the Somoza family. What this did was begin to turn many of the moderate sectors of Nicaragua against the Somoza government. By this time, the poor and the working class were very much opposed to them, and they were the ones who suffered most of the repression. But the business class, the middle class, remained pretty much apolitical. Now, however, the corruption, the greed was so evident that very large sectors of society were beginning to turn against him, and there were a number of opposition movements that began to build up. This culminates then in the insurrection that took place during 1978 and 79. Instigated by the Sandinista National Liberation Front, but with broad popular support among all sectors of society. Now, this is a very different dynamic than what's happened in El Salvador, where you've had a lot of polarization around different sides. In Nicaragua, pretty much everyone opposed the Somoza government. And so there was a popular insurrection, a broad uprising, that in July of 1979 overthrew the Somoza family. At the time they overthrew the Somoza family, he was one of the wealthiest men in the world. He owned the 26 largest businesses in Nicaragua. He owned over one-fifth of the national territory, personally, of which was the primary agricultural land. And so he had essentially consolidated a kingdom of Nicaragua, which he was the ruler. The insurrection is successful. The Sandinista National Liberation Front comes into power, establishes a provisional government that rules from 1979 to 1984 until they have the national elections. During this time, however, in 1979, the Sandinistas came into power. The Carter administration was in office. And the Carter administration chose to respond to this by approving $113 million, I think it was, in aid to help rebuild and reconstruct Nicaragua. This is a very destructive insurrection. Over 50,000 people were killed. And one of the things that Somoza did at the end when he realized he was going to lose was he sent his Air Force out and bombed the remaining parts of the cities. He bombed all the factories, he bombed the hospitals, bombed as anything he could before he left the country, so that when the Sandinistas took power, they would have a shell of a country. The Carter administration chose to respond by sending economic aid to rebuild Nicaragua, and about $75 million of this did reach Nicaragua before the Reagan administration took office in January of 1981. The Reagan administration, in their platform while they were running for elections, one of their key points was opposition to relationships with the Sandinista government, which they claimed was Marxist or communist. And so right from the beginning, one of the first acts the Reagan administration did was to suspend the aid that the Congress had approved under Carter. And then within a year, the Reagan administration is actively involved through the CIA in rallying what was left of the National Guard to form the Counter-Revolutionary Army. And counter-revolutionary in Spanish comes out contra-revolutionary, and so it has been shortened to the term contra. But within a year of Reagan being in office, his administration has now decided to work against the Nicaraguan government and forming the Contras. I think this is important to note because there was a dramatic shift in U.S. policy between the Carter administration and the Reagan administration. And if you read, there's a very key document called the Santa Fe document, which was a platform that the President Reagan ran on when he was a candidate. And it outlines U.S. policy towards Latin America. And one of the key points in it is overthrowing the Nicaraguan government. The initial justification for forming the aid to the Contras was to cut off, the Reagan administration was accusing Nicaragua of sending arms to El Salvador. And so they were forming a government or an army to fight against Nicaragua in order to cut off this arms flow. That has since changed, and there are other reasons now that the administration cites for backing the Contras. 1984, there are national elections in Nicaragua. Sandinista Party wins roughly 65% of the vote. And so Daniel Ortega becomes president, and in the National Assembly, the Sandinistas have about, I think it's 61 of the 96 seats. In 1985, the Reagan administration declared a trade embargo, an economic blockade on Nicaragua, and then just recently, in fact, the last few days, the $100 million in military and economic aid to the Contras has been approved, and so and that's where we are today, then, essentially, with the war. The war really began in the latter parts of 1982. The first 3 years, from 79 to 82, there was a lot of development within the revolution, but by 1982, the Contra army was beginning to make strikes inside Nicaragua from camps that they had set up in Honduras just north of the Nicaraguan border, making strikes into the country and then retreating back into Honduras.
Let me
just ask if there are questions at this point. This is what I would outline as the roots of the crisis here. Maybe I should say a little bit more about why there is this tension or animosity between the Reagan perspective and the Sandinista perspective in Nicaragua. Sandinistas came into power with four stated goals to reconstruct the government. They essentially are trying to rebuild the government along the lines of a nationalistic socialism, meaning that they want to look at the roots, Serenita for this. They want to recover the roots of Sandino and his philosophy of Nicaraguan nationalism as against U.S. influence. But they also want to construct a government that gives broad participation to the vast majority of the people, which would be the socialist side of that. And they have outlined four principles on which they're trying to rebuild this. One is political pluralism. Second is a mixed economy that would include both a government sector and a private sector. The third is a non-aligned foreign policy that is no longer aligned as closely with the United States. And fourthly, popular participation in social welfare. They have tried to develop their programs on what they have called the logic of the majority. And in Nicaragua, the majority of the people are rural and the majority are very poor. And so their development project has been focused on how to reach the majority of the people. This has caused problems and discomfort for many people in the middle class and the upper class because of their priorities. Now, from the Reagan administration's viewpoint, they are very concerned that Nicaragua is a Marxist-Leninist state on its way to being a communist totalitarian state that will be aligned with Cuba and the Soviet Union, and that this will give the Soviet Union a foothold on the American continent, and then would be able to deteriorate the U.S. position in the Western Hemisphere. And so I think there are two different perspectives going on here. The Nicaraguan perspective is much more of a north-south, the history of being dominated by U.S. imperialism and domination and trying to regain their sovereignty. From a U.S. perspective, it is an east-west struggle where the Soviet Union, through a proxy government in Nicaragua, is trying to maintain power. Any questions on the historical part of the roots now before we sort of look at who are the major role players and why, what are the dynamics that continue the war?
I don't know a lot about it. The Indians that live north near the Honduras border are somehow caught in the middle. Can you comment on that a little bit?
That's a good point. And it has to do a lot with the Nicaraguan history. The Miskito Indians, you may have heard quite a bit about. And when I drew the map here, I kind of dashed in this area here, which is the area where the Miskito Indians are found. About 100,000 Indian people in Nicaragua. This is where it's important to understand the history of the country, because this was the area of Nicaragua that was colonized by Great Britain. And so the dominant languages on this coast are English, which is spoken by black Caribbean people in this part of Nicaragua, and Miskito, their own language spoken in northern Nicaragua. One of the real problems that occurred here is there's a land here called the Mosquitia, which now, it used to be all inside of Nicaragua. The border between Honduras and Nicaragua used to come up right along here. But there was a border dispute between the government of Honduras and Nicaragua, and the World Court decided in the early 60s to redraw the boundary along the Rio Coco, which geographically makes a lot of sense. It seems to be a natural boundary through the area to put along a river. The problem is the Miskito Indians are a water-based people, and this is their major highway. And so it put an international border right through the middle of the area that they live in. And so many of them live in Honduras, many of them live in Nicaragua. In both countries, they're pretty much isolated and cut off from the main part of the countries, which take place on the eastern or the western side and are divided by the mountains here. Now, during the revolution, the Nicaraguan revolution took place almost exclusively on the Pacific half of the country. And there was very little going on as far as the Atlantic coast. The other thing was that the Somoza government essentially left these people alone. He opened up the whole Atlantic coast area to international companies that came in and mined and did logging and a lot of other exploitation of natural resources. But as far as the kind of internal repression that the National Guard was famous for over here, that was pretty much absent on the East Coast. So there was not the tremendous feelings of animosity towards Somoza. When the Sandinista triumph took place in 1979, one of the first things they did was try to consolidate the country. And so they sent over vast numbers of young people to tell the Indians that you're free. You've been liberated. Well, the first thing they said is, liberated from what? And there were a lot of problems that took place in the first few years, and a lot of abuses by the Sandinistas against the Indians, which essentially alienated the population of eastern Nicaragua. So that there has been much division among the Miskito people. Some of them have moved across the river into Honduras to be with the other part of the Miskito people. Some have moved out the river in this direction to be in large resettlement camps. Some have joined forces fighting with the Contras. Some have joined their made their own army. There's about seven or eight different groups that have all responded differently. But the one thing they all have in common is that there's a real distaste for the Sandinistas, particularly from that early history. There are a number of them that are now negotiating with the Sandinistas to try and work for some autonomy for this region. But people I know that work in that region have said that in the first 2 years of the revolution, the Sandinistas made enough mistakes with these people, primarily through cultural insensitivity, that they probably lost them for the next 20 years at least.
What kinds of abuses or mistakes are you talking about?
Well, one of the things that happened, this was a lot of the soldiers who were sent over here were the lowest ranks within the army. And so there were 17, 18, 19-year-olds who were sent over to this area, and people, if you follow what happened in Nicaragua following the revolution, there were, for the first few months at least, there was tremendous euphoria. I mean, people couldn't believe that they had actually gotten rid of the Somoza government. And you talk to people who watch the films and listen, just this tremendous excitement and this feeling that we can do anything. All the problems that have plagued us now, we can solve. And so they went, and in the Pacific Coast, this brought about very good results. The literacy campaign, the healthcare campaign, education, all these things took place because it was tremendous coming together of social willpower to do these. But all these Spanish-speaking people who had never even heard of this part of Nicaragua came flooding into here and said, come on, we're going to teach you to read and write, we're going to teach you about Sandino, we're going to teach you this. Well, there's the historical animosity from the East Coast towards the West Coast and real distrust of what they call these people over here the Spaniards. Historical distrust. Now all these young people are coming over and kind of lording over their authority, and some of the military ones, you know, there were military abuses. The human rights reports document about 75 killings and about another 75 disappearances during this time. So at least 150 incidents that resulted in deaths to Miskito Indians. So primarily scattered things, and the one thing that does distinguish this from, for example, from El Salvador is that the people who are responsible, the military people responsible for them were tried, and many of them are now in prison as a result. But the effect was to essentially alienate this entire part of the country from the Sandinistas.
How valid is the concern of a relationship between Cuba?
Okay, let me just go into then the major role players, because I think we can start to see some of the interaction between them. The main two, well, it's hard to prioritize, so I'll go through. One of the obvious ones is the Sandinista government, which is the Sandinista party is the dominant party in Nicaragua, and is made up both of members of the Sandinista Party and other people who are not party members but are very much sympathetic to what it's doing. And they are in power in Nicaragua at this point, and I mentioned what their 4 points or their platform is. The second important player is the U.S. government and particularly the Reagan administration, and the determination or the hostility, animosity that has developed between these two governments. The third important player are the Nicaraguan counter-revolutionaries. And it's hard to know exactly how many there are now. The estimates go anywhere from between 10 and 20,000. They are primarily, the bulk of them, in this area of Honduras, although there are some in northern Costa Rica. Just a brief history on how the Contras came into being. There were somewhere 10 or 12,000 National Guardsmen that Somoza used as his internal police force in Nicaragua at the time of the revolution, and roughly 6,000 to 7,000 of them left Nicaragua in 1979. Many of them got over to here and took boats up to El Salvador and resettled in Honduras. These are the remnants of the National Guard then, or what the CIA used to form the training camps here to begin to form an army, a counter-revolutionary army, to begin making attacks on the Sandinistas. And the bulk, the army has grown to about somewhere between 10 and 20,000, so probably the majority of the people in the army are no longer National Guardsmen. They are people who are, for whatever reason, disaffected with the government in Nicaragua, or there have been a lot of cases of kidnap and people being brought over and forced to fight with the army. For a variety of reasons, these are primarily campesinos or rural people, but all the key leadership positions are held by these former National Guardsmen. And that's been one of the real dilemmas for the Contras in trying to build popular support within Nicaragua, is they are identified with Somoza's National Guard. In fact, if you talk to the people in Nicaragua, they just call them La Guardia, the Guard. And so there's been a real, they've had a hard time shedding that image of being Somoza's guardsmen that just simply want to come back into Nicaragua and return Nicaragua to what it was before.
Yes. Mosquito Indians connected with the Contras?
This is where the Mosquito, there are some Mosquitos that work with the Contras. There are others who are fighting against the Sandinistas but are not working with the Contras. And it gets, it's a little bit confusing. But most of the Mosquitos, when you talk to them, say, we are not fighting to overthrow the Sandinista government, we're fighting to maintain our rights as people who live in this area. Whereas the Contras are unabashedly in favor of overthrowing the Sandinista government. So there's a distinction in what they're fighting for. The next two are pretty much are very interrelated. That is the internal opposition, the political parties, the business groups, one of the major newspapers, La Prensa, who oppose the Sandinista government internally and through legal means within the country, and then the Catholic Church hierarchy, headed by Cardinal Obando y Bravo, who is, there are 9 bishops in there. They vary in their opposition or their support, but the head of them, the Cardinal Obando y Bravo, is very much opposed. He has emerged as kind of the spokesperson for the internal opposition in Nicaragua. Another factor that we mentioned in El Salvador yesterday, I think is important to keep in mind in Nicaragua as well, is the organized poor. There's been a tremendous amount of organizing that went on both before and after the revolution among the poor. And this has also caused the Sandinistas a lot of headaches at times. For example, in their agrarian reform, the Sandinistas have tried to go at a kind of a moderate pace so it won't damage, so that the economy has a time to adjust to it. Well, the poor have been organized and they know that they have rights to land now, so they have been extremely putting a lot of pressure on the government, claiming the government is moving far too slow to grant them their rights. And so the Sandinistas feel pressure not only from this side, but also the people who are their supporters to move faster in the revolution. Another important factor is Cuba and the Soviet Union. And I should also put Western Europe and Latin America. But since these are the two that we always hear about, the majority of the Sandinistas' economic aid comes from countries in Latin America and Western Europe, such as Sweden, Norway, France, Italy. Canada is also a major donor, and countries throughout Latin America. Most of their military aid now comes from the Soviet bloc, and they receive a large amount of military aid from the Soviet bloc. And Cuban advisors in the fields of education, healthcare, and military support. So that is a factor as well. Finally, I've listed one here that you may have heard something about, which is the Contadora Nations. Contadora is an island off the coast of Panama, but it's where 4 Latin American nations, Mexico, Panama, Venezuela, and Colombia, originally met to try and work out a regional peace treaty in Central America. The countries in Latin America are very, throughout South and Central America, are very concerned with the kind of the tensions that are building up in Central America and the fear that a regional war could develop. And just to give you an idea of how likely that might be, is the arms shipments to Central America in the last 6 years have increased 20-fold. There are 20 times as much arms now present in Central America as there were 6 years ago. So we're talking about a tinderbox effect there that could go off at any time. These nations have banded together to try and work with these governments to bring about a Latin American solution to the problems in the region. And they now have the support of 5 more South American nations, and then they continue to work on the peace treaty. We can talk more about why that hasn't succeeded up to this point. These are the ones that I would list as the major characters, and it's the dynamics within them help us to understand what's happening. The U.S. government is directly supportive of the counter-revolutionaries, indirectly supportive of the internal opposition and the church hierarchy. The organized poor, for the most part, is supportive of the Sandinista government. Cuba and the Soviet Union are supportive of the Sandinista government. And the Contadora nations are trying to be a mediating factor in this. And one of the things that has happened, primarily because I think of the emphasis the Reagan administration has put on Nicaragua, is that Nicaragua has become very much involved in the whole East-West conflict. It is the whole, what originally began as a sort of a North-South wealthy United States versus poor Nicaragua has now become embroiled in an East-West perspective as well. Now, there was a question here that led me into this, and that was, what is the legitimate concern about?
Is the concern legitimate about the tie between Cuba and the Sandinistas?
The question is, is the concern legitimate about the tie between Cuba and the Sandinistas? A couple things. The Sandinistas have made no, or have not hidden at all, their sympathy or their friendship with the Cubans. Fidel Castro, during the 60s and the 70s, was very supportive of the Sandinistas, and there's a bond of friendship there. They have also made it quite clear that they want to develop a Nicaraguan revolution, not a Russian revolution, and not a Cuban revolution. And so they have been very firm in setting the boundaries where the Cubans and the Soviets can be involved in there. There is definitely influence in the state, particularly through the military, because Nicaragua has become almost dependent on those countries to get the military aid it feels it needs to ward off the Contras. But I'll just illustrate with an anecdote. We hear a lot about the Cubans and the Soviets, and there are Cubans and there are Soviets in Nicaragua, but there are also vast numbers of other international people there who are also working there, who we don't hear about so much. And I remember one time, a group I had up in northern Nicaragua, somebody always asked the question, what about the Cubans? And this woman kind of threw up her hands and she said, you people always ask about the Cubans. She said, quite frankly, I'm not worried about the Cubans. If you want to know, ask me. I'm worried about the Swiss. There are Swiss people everywhere in this country, and I think they're taking over. She was joking, but the point is there are vast numbers of people from all over the world who are working in Nicaragua in a variety of ways, and we're selectively focused on the Cubans and the Soviets because that brings a strong emotional reaction from the United States population. Now, as far as whether it's a legitimate concern, it's hard to say. I think that the longer the war goes out and the more Nicaragua is forced to continue its military dependency on the Soviet Union, that there's going to be more and more influence to the Soviet Union. So I think that if the United States is worried about Soviet influence in Nicaragua, it's doing precisely the best thing possible to make sure there's good Soviet influence in Nicaragua. And that is continuing the war, forcing Nicaragua to be more dependent on the aid there. On the other hand, the Soviet Union has told Nicaragua quite clearly that it will not let Nicaragua develop a relationship with the Soviet Union like the Soviet Union has with Cuba. Cuba is a tremendous drain on the Soviet economy. It's essentially subsidized in many ways by the Soviet Union. And the Soviet Union has told Nicaragua we are not going to develop another one like that in the Western Hemisphere. The Central American nations do not figure prominently in Soviet areas of influence, and they have not like Eastern Europe does. And they have given pretty clear signals that they will give limited support. Now, on the other hand, like I said, I think that the Soviet Union is delighted to see anything that causes the United States headaches. And so if this war in El Salvador causes U.S. headaches, situation in Nicaragua does. So I don't doubt that they are involved there. But I don't see Nicaragua becoming another Cuba in the sense of a Soviet dominated state.
In light of that, and going back to your comments about the reason that the U.S. government has become involved in this, and that is because of the influence of communism in this hemisphere, I'm wondering how valid that actually is as far as the real reason we're involved down there. I know that's the public reason given by Reagan and his administration, but with the information you just told us, I mean, I know the foreign advisors must know that about the Soviet Union not really wanting another Cuba. That can't be the real reason that we're fighting a war down there.
Well, I think in my interpretation from reading the speeches that the Reagan administration makes and their documents, I think that it's primarily ideological. I think that there is a very, very rigid East-West perspective, and the Reagan administration operates out of a perspective, if you're not for us, then you're against us. It essentially divides the world up into two camps, the Soviet camp and the United States camp. Nicaragua clearly does not want to be in the U.S. camp in the sense of dependent on the U.S., and therefore, in that mindset, it leaves only one alternative, that it must be in the Soviet camp. The difficulty is there are large, increasing numbers of third world nations that don't want to be in either one. They formed a group called the Non-Aligned Nations. many of them trying to address the dynamics that affect their countries, not always in an East-West perspective, but through other dynamics. And that's what Nicaragua's stated desire is, to be a non-aligned nation. They say they're very, you know, they want to have good relations with the United States, they want to have good relations with the Soviet Union, they want to be a sovereign state. And they point out to the fact that the first country they went to seeking international aid was the United States, not the Soviet Union. But that was cut off when the Reagan administration came into power. So I think the U.S. is very concerned, well, for a couple reasons. I think they're concerned about having a country in Central America that provides an alternative model of development, where the poor, I talked about the logic of the majority, where the poor really do have some control of their lives, and they're learning to read and write, they're learning to, you know, have healthcare and so forth. And that is threatening when you have, if that kind of model were to spread to El Salvador and Honduras and Guatemala, the United States could lose control over a region that it considers its own backyard. But I also think that, particularly in the case of President Reagan, not so much his advisor necessarily, but for him, that he honestly believes that this nation is now full of communists. And I don't know if you saw, anybody saw, read the statements just a couple days ago when he compared Nicaragua to South Africa. Because, you know, President Reagan has been adamant in opposing sanctions, economic sanctions against South Africa, saying that would only do damage to the people there. But then he has had an economic blockade against Nicaragua. And he, you know, when asked about that, he said that Nicaragua is a totalitarian dungeon where there are no human rights and it's a communist through and through, and that South Africa is trying to build a democracy. Well, you know, I haven't been to South Africa, but I know many people who have. It's hard for me to, and I have been to Nicaragua many times and traveled widely in the country and talked to as many people as I can. And it's that kind of comparison is really startling.
One more thing. Sure. I understand that Reagan stands there and that he's really adamant about communism, but I'm wondering about the economic factors involved in our decision to fight the war there, and the fact that this is some prime land that some major U.S. companies could be exploiting, and some people also. And so I'm wondering how big of a factor the economic.
The question is, how big of a factor are the economic interests in Nicaragua? And I think you have to look at short-term and long-term factors there to understand that. Short-term, I don't think that the economic interests justify the overwhelming interests that the Reagan administration has put in there. And I say that for a number of reasons. One, they're just, in terms of actual dollars, there has not been that much U.S. Influence there. Compared to the amount of money we're spending to oust the Sandinistas. Secondly, the Sandinistas were perfectly willing to work with all the U.S. companies that were there. In fact, they were working fairly well with them, but now those companies have had to shut down because the U.S. has put an economic blockade in place. So there, short-term, I'm not sure the economic reason is valid. Long-term, I think it's extremely valid, because what I think really concerns both the companies and the Reagan administration long term is if Nicaragua were to succeed as a model of development, as an alternative model, then other countries follow this kind of thing where they begin to have sovereignty over their own natural resources, to name a few things. Then this does begin to impinge economically, because what happens if Argentina or Brazil or Mexico or some of the larger countries, or what if this spreads quite a bit more? Then we are losing a large sector of our export economy and our control over the international realm. So I think long range they're very concerned about that. And that's at least certainly what the Nicaraguans believe. They believe that why they are so threatening is because they represent an alternative model that, if it were to succeed, would force the United States to change its economic relationship with the rest of the world. There was a hand, Jan.
I don't know if you want to say anything about this or not, but what is the bleak scenario that the Contadoran countries may have in mind, where that other people do, about how a war would stack up if the war didn't break out there?
Okay. One thing, well, the main thing, I think the major concern is that U.S. troops may get involved in the region, and that there may be an incident, such as we had in Vietnam, one kind of incident that triggers that and brings on the onslaught, and that will trigger what they call a regionalization of the war. There are a lot of problems. For example, the Contras now have an army the same size as the Honduras army. So there is a foreign army in Honduras that is not under Honduran control, it's under U.S. control. And there have been over 100 documented cases where Honduran civilians have been murdered by the Contras. So you've got two armies occupying the same territory, one that has one that's the national army that has very little control over this other foreign army that occupying it there. But the other thing is, if there were to be an outward, if the U.S. were to militarily intervene in one of these countries, many people feel that all sides involved would just would realize they had no more to lose in sort of holding back, and there would just be a general breakout of the war. If the United States were to intervene militarily in Nicaragua, the Sandinistas would return. They have laid out contingency plans. They would return into the mountains to conduct a guerrilla warfare against the United States. It's quite possible they would begin to coordinate with the guerrillas in El Salvador. We don't know what effect this would have on Honduras or the situation in Guatemala, but there would be, the fear is that things have been so stacked up that it would just take a spark to ignite it. Now, the U.S. policy in the region, and I think this is important for understanding, because I think it's difficult for us oftentimes to understand the approach of the Contras, or what is the strategy there. The United States says that the Contras are fighting only to pressure the Nicaraguan government into negotiating with them. If you ask the Contras, they say they're fighting to overthrow the Sandinista government. But they're doing it through a very particular and deliberate policy, and the problem is it has taken the United States quite a while to get them trained to do it this way. The Contras, when they first started, wanted to be able to march into Managua, and that's not realistic for the strength of the Sandinista government. So they've been working in what's been called low-intensity warfare, which is the United States has learned a lot from the other guerrilla movements that have overthrown governments in the past. Low-intensity warfare seeks to undermine the confidence of a people in its government, its ability to govern, by attacking the economic infrastructure of the government, by attacking civilians, by showing that the government cannot protect its people. And this is very much the strategy of the counter-revolutionaries. They very rarely engage the Sandinista military directly. What they do is come into Nicaragua and make strikes into the country against anyone they identify as being sympathetic to the Sandinista government. And what this has done is that their major attacks have focused on projects that the government has been promoting, such as schools, healthcare, and cooperatives. And so you have vast numbers of teachers who have been killed, vast number of healthcare workers, vast number of campesino families living on cooperatives, because anyone who has identified one as being a potential leader in the community, and secondly, of having any sympathy or working with the Sandinista government, is targeted and assassinated. Why do they do this? They do this because what the effect of this is to terrorize the people and to cause people not to cooperate with the government. Then this in turn frustrates the Sandinistas' plans for trying to extend healthcare and things out into these parts of the country. And the hope is to paralyze the country or to essentially bleed the country long enough that you stir up popular dissent or people just begin to say it's not worth it having this government in here. We're constantly in the attack so that the support for the Sandinistas crumbles. The other thing that it tries to do is to force the Sandinistas to take increasingly repressive measures to stay in power. And we see the effects of this. The Sandinistas closed one of the major opposition newspaper, La Prensa, about a month ago. They have expelled one of the bishops of the Catholic Church who was in Washington lobbying for the Contra aid, for the $100 million. All of these things make sense to them in their context, but they, in our context, give more justification for pressuring them. And so it can sort of a downward spiral. The more that the Contras are able to attack these things, the more the Sandinistas react, the more, and especially with the economic problems in the country now, because the economy is in shambles because of the war, it stirs up popular discontent. So far, there is a lot of discontent, but so far that has not translated to support for the Contras. And part of that is because the Contras still have the image of being the remnants of the National Guard.
It seems to me that one of the unique things, the features of what's happening in Nicaragua is that the vast number of non-U.S. government people, citizens that have been down and have some first-hand experience, like the groups that and Europeans who are traditionally allies of the U.S. and Canadians, Europeans that have been involved, that makes it much different than most other situations. Is that there's a whole different understanding of what's going on. That's not coming from the government, our government, but coming from other people's experience.
Yeah, I think this is one of the really key differences in the dynamic that's going on there, and it translates into even public opinion polls. You know, one of the really startling things about this vote that went through for the $100 million is that when the American population was polled on it, 62% said they opposed it, 25% said they favored it. So by more than 2-1, they opposed it, and yet our elected officials are not following that. They are following the directives of the administration. But there are thousands of U.S. citizens who have been to there and, you know, have had experiences that have convinced them that there's that the administration's arguments are not valid.
Yeah, Paul. Well, I just had two little vignettes, and I want to compliment you for your level-headed presentation, because when I came back last summer, I found that I was so angry at what I had seen that I was unable to speak. And so I want to compliment you on that. I really enjoyed this. When we visited different churches in the poor sections and in the wealthier sections, one thing I remember was we visited a very wealthy church one Sunday, and there was worship, and the people were quite excited because Archbishop Ubravo was going to be there, not to speak, but to hear confessions, and people were lined up to, you know, to say confessions to him. And it was in the parking lot were Mercedes and very expensive American cars and the most expensive clothing you could imagine. I mean, they were dressed to the hilt. And what we heard there from the student who was preaching was a very inflammatory sermon in favor of the conscience. The other thing that I remember being very surprised about, because I had been influenced by the press calling this a communist country and so on, I was surprised when I got there that at the amount of private ownership of property. I figured this was all, communist-controlled economy and so on. And we visited a farmer, and we asked him about this. He had about 80 acres, and he grew plantain. And what about the government ownership of property? He said, our government does own a lot of property now, and it's the best land in the country, but it's trying to give away this land. Well, where did it get this? Well, it's the Somoza land that the government took over, and they're trying to get rid of it. And he pointed out some farms down the road, and he said, at the time Somoza was overthrown, they were looking at my farm. My farm would have been one of the next to be taken over, and I would have been out. And I do think that part of their problem in their economy is that it has some of the same weaknesses that the East German economy, and we traveled in East Germany a few years ago. The economy in East Germany suffers from being a government managed economy, and I think the same thing is true there, that even though the prices for the farmers are sort of guaranteed and so on, I think there's a little bit of a economic stagnation there that's due to the lack of some good, lively capitalism.
Well, I think there are three factors that are important for understanding what's happening in the economy in Nicaragua. And probably the most important is the war. 50% of the national budget is going to defense now. Secondly is the economic blockade led by the U.S., which has caused a lot of problems. And third has been government mismanagement of the economy.
And
those three together bring a lot of things. I want to just mention a couple things. The danger with this kind of explanation, I think it's helpful for us to get a kind of a conceptual frame of what's happening, but the danger is that it leaves out the people. And that's one of the things that I find so frustrating about our press is that you never hear anything about this sector in our press, the organized poor or the unorganized poor. But it's, you know, our press tends to focus on the main role players, the government, the countries, the contra, and the church hierarchy. And To illustrate this in one way, the day I arrived in Nicaragua a month ago, two major things happened that shook the country. The first was a landmine. Well, there was a truck carrying 32 civilians up in northern Nicaragua that hit a Contra-laid U.S.-made landmine and killed 31 of the people, killed 12 children, 12 women, and 7 men. And this just traumatized the country because this kind of thing is happening a lot. And people, these are people who are not involved in the war. They're innocent civilians. The same day, the Sandinistas expelled the bishop I mentioned who had been in Washington lobbying for the Contra aid. Well, when I returned to this country, you know, the second incident had gotten widespread press, a lot of articles about the Sandinista persecution of the church and expelling this bishop. But nobody, you know, very, very few places even mentioned the kind of death and destruction that the Contras are causing against these people. And one of my friends in northern Nicaragua is a woman. I'll just tell her story briefly because it illustrates the kind of thing. She is a woman from a very poor campesino family. Her family is made up of her mother, her father, and six brothers. And at the time of the revolution, they had been active in working to overthrow the Somoza regime. She received a scholarship to go study in Managua. And so in 1982, she was studying in Managua. Hers had been, and one of these church families had been very active in the base communities. And 5 of her brothers and her father were what are known as delegates of the word. These are lay leaders who go out and they preach to people. And they, since the priests can't get out to these areas, they perform the functions of the church. But have been very important in organizing and involving the poor. Well, when she was in Managua, the Contra attacked her town. They came into her town, attacked her town. They went to specifically to her house and dragged out her father and her 5 brothers and tortured them all and killed all of them and left her mother and fortunately her 14-year-old brother had been away at the time. So they left the mother in the house, took all the men out and killed them. So she received word in Managua that her family had just been massacred, has gone back to the area to work with her mother. I just got a letter from her the day before I came up here that her last remaining brother had been killed by the Conchas as well. This is the kind of human level of suffering we don't hear about much here. And that's what I think we have to have in context for the rest of this. It's important to understand the conceptual framework, but we also really need to know what's happening to the people there. And this is a country, 12,000 people now have died because of the Contra War. And these are people that lost 50,000 people before that in the insurrection. So it's a country that is just being bled. And it's because of this strategy of low-intensity warfare, where you never have a full declared war. You never send in the Marines. You just keep bleeding the country bit by bit by bit. But I asked someone there once about low-intensity warfare, and they said, low-intensity warfare means you kill low-intensity people. It's the people like this that you don't make the news back here. And that, for me, is where I think as Christians, we are really called to evaluate what our country is doing in that region. I think we're getting pretty close to the end. The last thing I want to do, because some people had asked me yesterday about, don't give us all this information, then don't tell us what we can do.
Yeah, right.
So I did just get a couple things if you're interested in responding to some different ways. And you're free to choose, obviously, the way you respond. Some people have been asking for where I work, in case you are interested. There are people who have been on some of the travel seminars that the center or other groups have organized, and they can tell you about that. I think that's one of the most important things North Americans can do is go and see for themselves what's happening. So if any of you are interested, you can talk to me about that. The other thing is that the Lutheran Church, I think, is very lucky to have what's called the Lutheran Coalition on Latin America, actually LUCOLA. And I put the address up here. It is coordinated by a woman named Susan Bercolo, who I think is LCA pastor, but she was a missionary in Chile for many years, and coordinates this. And there are a number of sheets on it available from Bob Bacon, the Resource Center. He's asked that people take one per congregation since he has a limited amount here. But this is a coalition that keeps track, particularly of Lutheran influence in Central America and Latin America, but also gives news updates, and I think it would be a very helpful one for our churches to be connected with. So you're welcome to take one of those. If you're interested in having ongoing updates that provide an alternative perspective to what's available to the mass media, one of the best is called the Coalition for a New Foreign and Military Policy. And this is a coalition of various different groups, such as America's Watch and the Washington Office on Latin America, which are human rights monitoring organizations, Witness for Peace, a variety of groups that try and give a grassroots perspective have formed a coalition group, and they give regular mailings, and you can write to them and ask to be on their mailing list. Finally, there is a Central America legislative hotline, which you can call at any time, and they will tell you what are the issues currently going on and what are, you know, the factors involved. So if you need an update from time to time on what's happening. There are a variety of other things as well. One of the things you can do, if you like, we have through my office, the Center for Global Service and Education, we publish a bi-monthly newsletter called Global Perspectives. And if you're interested in getting that, there's no charge, it's free. You can simply write to us and ask to be put on the mailing list, and you'll get some of the center's mailings, which will also keep you updated. But I think the important thing for citizens in this country is to be in touch with our elected officials, because they do have the responsibility to respond to us as their citizens. And the thing about Congress is the way Congress tends to function, it responds to one of two things. It responds to the agenda that the administration is setting forth, and that's why I think Congress has been so embroiled on Nicaragua rather than El Salvador, because that is where the administration's preoccupation is. But it also responds to grassroots efforts. If it receives a lot of letters on things, or if it receives a lot of attention, such as on the farm crisis or on other issues, then it will respond. And that's where we can play our role as concerned citizens and Christians in being in touch with our elected officials. So even though it's very frustrating sometimes to keep writing and feel like nothing is happening, I think it's critical that on this issue or any other issue that's important to us, that we're in contact with them. So thank you very much for coming. I appreciate the interaction with all of you.